Okay, this is a Shir on the Rav that is the Rav on the Gilas Esther. And when the Rav started talking about any one topic, it just, he covered such an incredible breadth of information. And while there's many different approaches one can take to the Gilas Esther, Nechama Leibowitz is a beautiful treatise on the textual nuances of the book. And that's more of what we'll be doing on Shabbos. Maybe you've seen Yoram Chazoni, he's a politician in Israel. He wrote a book called The Dawn, not Dawn. That's a book by Elie Wiesel. The Dawn, which is a book that tries to derive political lessons from Megillat Esther. So there are listen, the Tanakh is not just a book about morals. There are phenomenal political lessons from Shmuel Bet. Phenomenal political lessons from the last 12 prakim of Sefer Bereishis with Yosef in the political scheme framework. So Rav Soloveitchik had a multi-leveled approach from, because he has articles in many different realms explaining the Book of Esther. What I would like to start with tonight. Notice that I didn't ask to have the text in front of you, so I want to start, just get our feet wet with the first thing that's here, insights into Megillat Esther. So here, his main focus really is not on the first few prakim, although that's certainly introductory information to help us understand what's going on in the salvation of the people. The main focus of this short article has to do with a certain tension that exists between the way men and women are doing things in the book. And it shouldn't evade our attention that what's going on between Ahasuerus and Vashti, what's going on between the his advisors about what to do about a wayward wife, it would almost seem like a joke in a parody or maybe even a satire, but in this time in Persia, there were rules that actually on the books. We have the rule numbers about important matters of state not being able to be determined unless we are well imbibed with wine. And then someone will write down the things we discuss, and then we'll raise them further when we're sober the next day. And it's insane, no? If you're hearing this for the first time. Okay, so for my Shabbos year, I'm actually bringing in those Persian texts. And you see what's going on in chapter one, right? So this is the tension between men and women in Persia. The women, and Vashti is a Babylonian name, the women are certainly Persian women. But there is a large influx of Babylonian women who were not killed in the battle where Cyrus took over the crumbling Babylonian Empire, right? You even get a picture. This is such an unlovely picture, but all too reminiscent of some of our own problems in Tanakh. But you get the picture in Daniel chapter 5 of a Babylonian Empire that it's gotten ahead of itself. All they're doing is just drinking. Remember the case where the name of the handwriting comes on the wall, the name of Tekel of Farsin, because Nebuchadnezzar's grandson is just sitting in there. They're just imbibing at all times. You know, with these kings, they take care of their inner circle and they drink in all night and they sleep till 4 in the afternoon and prepare for the next party. And it's so overboard. I would say that the beginning of that picture in Shlomo's kingdom, where you read about the incredible, it's waste. It becomes waste with all of his expenditures and all. And okay, so he took care of the poor also. But it's just, when a nation behaves the way Ahasuerus is behaving in chapter 1 and 2, where we know from Persian documentation, the Persians were very boorish. They loved a good time. They loved to drink. They made their decisions while drunk. if you look at Yeshayahu chapter 30, Hosea, Amos, about the kings who are drunk all the time, the kings who just interested in taking care of their inner circle and staying in power and not interested in taking care of Hashem's people. This is what takes down kingdoms. Add to this the fact that we know that prior to the picture you get from Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 5, the Babylonians were very cultured, they were very accomplished, they were scientific, they created some of the early wonders of the world, and they were certainly more accomplished than the Persians in these terms. It's just that the Persians were better soldiers at this time in history, and they wiped them out. So the women survived. See, what you have in Persia is a lot of Babylonian women, exemplified by Vashti, who remember the past and they're far more cultured men. And here, now these Babylonian women are married to Persian men who act like, if you know what I'm talking about, you'll get it in a second, Ralph crammed it in The Honeymooners. Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Never really.
Yes, but you know, the fact when you always have to say, of course, in reality, he knew she was the boss and he acted that way, right? But he has to say, and she was quite happy letting him feel he's boss, right? As long as she knows she's the bottom boss, you know. So he's in every other show, he's always talking about, I'm the general of this ship, and the general makes the decisions on this ship. Right, so you know, she's just
you know, he was threatened physical violence, not to the moon.
Right, right. Never. Of course, but you couldn't get away with even saying
not
that
now,
today.
Sure.
Of course, you know. Right, so it's a Hashverosh actually practicing the violence, but making it's a law about men and women, but it's really deep down about Persia and Babylon and Persia. You know, to make sure that these women don't try to bring up any stupid, any foolish notions about bringing up the past. This is Persian now, and we like our wine. So this is when Rav Shimon Bar Yochai asks, because that's what Jews always ask when we have such a Haman comes. Haman must be some reaction to something we've done wrong. So what did we do to deserve Haman's decree? And the Gemara's answer is, not just that they attended Ahasuerus's party, that they enjoyed it. Now, again, I'm not giving a commercial for keep doing shameless plugs for my Shabbos shir, but I'm going to give you the nine Persian kings, actually the 10 Persian kings, and we're going to try to figure out based on the data in Megillas Esther, two references to Ahasuerus, one in Ezra, one in Daniel, to figure out who. Which one of these 10 kings is Ahasuerus? He's got to be one of them, right? So we'll see where it fits and how it works. Chazal have him celebrating the fact that the Jews are not returning to rebuild their temple. Now, I must tell you that that is somewhat anachronistic, right? That would put him before Cyrus, and it just doesn't make sense. But it put him before Darius. Darius the first. So I would just say that when Chazal say that, they're telling us a deeper truth. Remember what I said yesterday in the shir about Amalek? None of you were there, so I can say it again. that when Chazal say that Dina married Shimon, right? Now it's famous, right? You've heard it? No one? You've heard it. Dina married Shimon. Now it's one thing if they shared the same father but not the same mother, but these two share the same mother too. That's forbidden to a Ben Noach. What is Chazal saying that Shimon married Dina? So when I see a medrash like that, I try, and this it gets into my parsha book pretty often, I try to figure out what's the deeper message here. I can't believe that Chazal are going to say that, I mean, like Rabbeinu Tam says in the Tosfos and Megillah, I do not accept that Mordechai and Esther were men. I don't accept. And that what did she do? She went from the arms of Ahasuerus, went to the mikveh, and went to the arms of Mordechai? Impossible. Really impossible. What king is going to let a queen out of the palace and go home to a Jewish man? This is impossible. kivin avadati. So Rabbeinu Tam just says, I don't accept the plain literal meaning of this medrash. It means something deeper. Fine. Almost every Rishon says something like that. So what's the deeper meaning of Dina marrying Shimon? I really think that this is the pshat of what the Chazal meant. This is a very famous Maimer Chazal that only Binyamin has the power to wipe out Amalek. That's why Shaul is from Binyamin. He's tasked with it, but he didn't succeed. Mordechai and Esther from the, right? Why Binyamin more than any other tribe? Not because he wasn't involved with Mechiras Yosef. That would invalidate Yehuda, and Yehuda is certainly involved with wiping out Amalek. So why Binyamin more than any other tribe?
He didn't bow down.
Exactly. He didn't bow down to Esav. Only someone who did not fashter his descendants by bowing to Esav gets to wipe out Amalek. Right? Now, are you familiar that when Yaakov first introduced his family to Amalek, it says he showed his 11 children? Wait a second, Yaakov had 12 children. Who did he not show?
Dina.
Right. Now, the Medrash says why he didn't show Dina, because he thought that Esav would want to marry her, so Yaakov kept her. But it's a big musser. Esav had an incredible yichus. Father's a patriarch, grandfather's a patriarch, brother's a patriarch, mother's a matriarch, my grandmother's a matriarch. None of that would bring him to Mutav, but a good wife would. Right? So Chaval Yaakov, you could have given your daughter to someone who's gemalt. Instead, she's going to be taken from by someone who's not even gemalt. Chamor. Now, another medrash I cannot accept. Dina is 5 at this time. Esav is 99. I cannot accept that Yaakov was worried that his 99-year-old brother with all his wives is going to have his eyes on the 5-year-old niece. I'm not macabre.
Well, is that so different than Yitzchak and Rivka?
I'm not macabre that either, actually. I don't think Rashi was either. Rashi says at the end of the parsha that from here we see that let's go ask her if she's interested, that you should always ask a girl, who do you want to marry? You don't have to ask a 3-year-old. You don't have to ask an 11-year-old. Right? Rishpam proved, look at Rishpam in Parshas Chayisara, and you see he proves that she's 17, 20, she's much older. From the Gemara. So why does it mean that she's 3? Go look at Bereishis Rabbah and Koheles Rabbah about where it says that she's 3, and I think you'll figure it out yourself. It's always connected to Rabbi Kiva's students dying. And Rabbi Kiva building up afterwards, Sarah and Nifka. It's something there. There's something hinted in the text. Fine, Smichud Parshios and whatnot, but don't take this always literally. I think what's happening here is, how do you know that it was Dina that Yaakov hid from Esav? Maybe it was another one of his children. Maybe he showed Dina and it was a different child that was hidden to make it. No, don't be stupid. If Chazal knew, it was Dina who was hidden. Because if Dina was shown, then another brother could have been the one to destroy Amalek because he didn't bow to Esau. But wait a second. So this is a fact you need to know. In Divrei HaYomim, it says that the Sheiris HaPleta of Amalek was wiped out by Shevet Shimon. Azoshtet? There's no more genealogical Amalek. The mitzvah is to wipe out people who behave like Amalek. The Rav wrote about that too. There's no more genealogy. Certainly with Bilbo Lumos, we don't know what Amalek is, right? Wait a second. How did Shimon get the ability to wipe out Amalek? He bowed down to Esav with everybody else. Answer?
His descendants.
Right. His descendant to Dina, who didn't bow down to Esav. Why? Because she was in the box. Okay, right. So you see, when I read a medrash like this, I'm trying to figure out what's going on, what's the deeper point of it, and this is what the Rav used to do also, I think, when it comes to whole areas of biblical presentation, which was what we're doing between the men and the women. So now he discusses how Mordechai and Esther both approach the same problem. Apparently, Esther is not aware of it. She's got her rose-colored glasses in the palace because she seems to be surprised by Mordechai's news that our people are being threatened.
But why would she have known about it?
Yeah, in a Benami. Right, it didn't reach her. I don't know, maybe there are tablets, papers, I don't know, maybe there are things that get around, but she's not aware of it. So Mordechai and Esther have a discussion about what needs to be done, right? So the Rav analyzes the conversation. I don't need to do it in the text because you all know it, but I'm not going to be medactic in the show notes. But you all know that Mordechai tasks her with doing something, and she balks at it at first. Right? She says that to run in and besiege the king without a plan. You know, there's this pesky little law here in Persia that once a law is signed, Yareg Val Yabo, the king can't turn it away. Remember, Darius didn't want Daniel to go into the lion's den, but they said, there's nothing I could do. All I can do is hope that your God is going to shut the mouth of the lions, right? Mordechai just says, listen, of course this is why you've come to this situation now. This was before the Makkah. But she knows some things that maybe he doesn't know about why it's chashuv for him to know some facts about what's to do and what's not to do. So here is the way the rub. This is I don't know if you can get away with doing this today. You might get fired from Harvard for what I'm about to say. Someone did have to, I think, resign from Harvard for saying this, something like this. He said that roles for men and women are set from the Gan Eden story. Now, those roles may switch in some ways. I think it's a beautiful thing. I see men are really helping out. The men are taking the kids to school. The men are staying behind, and adrabam. The women are very good at helping the men with b'zeat apecha toch alechem. Right? So very often the women who are the breadwinners.
Yeah, more than that helping out.
Right? Yeah, remember the joke, the Rebbe, the kid comes to the Rebbe and says, Rebbe, I need you to help me find a wife. He goes, what are you talking about? You're married already. So he goes, yeah, I know, but we're not getting by on one salary. So the men are supposed to sweat and earn a living and put food on the table. You know, Yitzchak likes Esav because he helps me do what my job is, which is b'zeat apecha toch alechem. Where did it ever become that at least I hope that he's sweating in the Beis Medrash at least, but unless it's earning money to pay for the family, where did this ever end? Speaking of the honeymooners, remember where she wanted to get a job to help out with the rent? No wife of mine is getting a job. No wife of mine has to help out with the rent. I'll take care of that. In that episode?
No, right,
So she ends up getting a job, of course, because she is the captain of the ship. But you get the point, is that when did this happen? But one thing is for sure, is that the woman is definitely crossing over and helping out with the sweat of the brow, you shall eat bread. And I see, Baruch Hashem, I see certainly with my own family, is that the men are also helping out with the raising of the children, to a great extent, and they're very present. So the Rav says that when it comes to b'zeyat apecha toch alechem, that's today and tomorrow. I got to worry about today. The man is always thinking the short term. And I've got a plan. I got to work out something for tomorrow. The woman, however, her whole point is b'etzav tel dibam. She knows how to plan ahead. Women are good at bina, which is what you need to differentiate between X and Y and to make a plan, and then, right? So women are excelling in the things that need more time. So that's what's going on between Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai wants her to quickly do something. And she says, no, don't just do something. We should stand there for a bit and we'll figure something out. So then the Rav used to say that this is true about not only Mordechai and Esther, but wherever you have a sort of a tension, and if I recall properly, I think he said it regarding the seven neviot. It's okay from, is there any cold water in something not carbonated? The seven neviot. Now, I think, I don't know if I did it in the Mishnah class, but I'm pretty sure I did it one of the previous years, that if you take the full list of the seven neviot in Chazal, Megillah Daf Yud Daled, you familiar? Right, that's in chronological order. It starts with Sarah, then Miriam, and then Devorah, and then Hannah, and then Abigail, then Huldah, and then Esther. Thanks so much. Each one of these women have some kind of an association opposite a man. I'm not saying always, but they clash with a man sometimes in one particular case, like when Sarah and Avraham have different plans for Yitzchak and Yishmael, and Hashem tells Avraham, Shema B'Kolah. Right? Not just Shema Lo, Shema B'Kolah, which the Medrash says, B'Nevuah Shelah. She's better Navi than you are, Avraham. It's a famous Maimon Chazal that Sarah had was greater at connecting prophetically than Avraham was. Miriam, who's our sort of protagonist, if you will, is Amram. Right? The Rambam, we did discuss recently, the Rambam says that Amram was a big mechadesh mitzvahs before Moshe Rabbeinu. And all the Nosei Kelim on the page said, where did he get this from? I don't get it. It's also in my book, but the Rambam is l'shitasa. That Amram seems to have instituted for Klal Yisrael in Yonei Ishus. The Gemara in Yesh Nochlin about divorcing the wives, remarrying the wives. What divorce and marriage? The Rambam says that before Matan Torah, there were no such institutions. So when the Rambam says, Avram did this, Yitzchak did that, Yaakov did that, and each one got mitzvahs, each one davened, and then Amram was Mosif mitzvahs until Moshe gave us the Torah. So Amram and Miriam clash. Same Gemara in Yesh Nochlin, you all know, right? Rashi brings it down pretty famously in the beginning of the second paragraph. Right? So that Amram and Miriam clashed regarding whether we should throw in the towel or not. Again, the man looks at tomorrow and says, there is nothing to live for now. They're just killing everybody. The woman plans and says, no. And wouldn't you know it, the one boy born, the one child born after that, he's the one. Right, so
they clapped their appreciations.
Right. That she was telling them that you're shachok Hashem Mishal Paro. Next one is Devorah. So Devorah is with Baruch Ben Avinoam. You know, he doesn't want to go into. Right? So he's thinking right this minute, and she's thinking the long run, and of course when she says, this salvation will come through a woman, you think it's her, but no, it's Yael who smacks the All right, next one is Abigail. Well, that's maybe the best one, right? Abigail and David. You know, if Abigail correctly tells David, if you do this thing, you will never become king. He doesn't say so in the text, but she said, don't let this be, you know, this will be a stumbling block for you. And the Gemara understands her to be saying that. And then he admitted it, right? They will not allow you to become king. I know God appointed you king, but this is not what's on, you don't do this. Okay. In the Gemara in Megillah, she asks him, why do you want to kill my husband? He goes, because he's married to Malchus. And she says, no, you can't say that. Is an acknowledged king. He's still alive. As much as you know you've been crowned king, you can't say, if my husband thought you were king, he wouldn't have behaved that way with you. Right? That's Megillah Daf Yudalad, and everybody knows it. Now, coincidentally, Medrash Shocher Tov, which is also called Medrash Tehillim, Perek Yudalad, which starts around Novol B'Libo and Elohim, so it discusses Novol and Avigayo and that whole story. There, she comes down the mountain and says, oh, yeah, Adoni Melech, oh, please, Melech, Melech, you know, she said, and she says, please, I beg of you, don't do this to my husband. He deserves to be killed because he's more of the Malchus, but you can't do this because it would be a hindrance to your ultimate Malchus when you become king over all of Israel. But she speaks to him as though he's king. Kivayochol, that even as king, you don't have the right to do this to my husband. Whatever it is, David admits it immediately that you're a greater Nevi'ah than I am. At least how the Gemara presents it, that why you must listen to her. Okay, another interesting thing, I don't think the Rav pointed this out, but I'm pointing it out to you, is that the priestesses and prophetesses of the ancient Near East were not allowed to get married. You were either married to every man in town or you were married to no man in town. Meaning every man got you with their fertility festivals and their tumah and their temples, right? But they couldn't marry into anybody.
What about the men?
The man priests, maybe not also, stamina, right? I mean, that's very, very common in the Catholicism. But then I'm not as sure. There are exceptions there. But the women certainly could not marry. Every one of our seven prophetesses, the Tanakh tells us who they were married to and the husband's name. Right? So Hannah, her protagonist seems to be Eli, where they're debating about whether she's drunk. We learn all the halachas of tefillah from Hannah, you know, that Eli should have known, perhaps. But okay, that's then the two left. Mordechai and Esther, which is, of course, what we're building up to. The last one is not the textually based. The last one is based on Midrash. Yirmiyahu and Chulda. Yeah. That when they found the book, they decided to take it to Chulda, not to Yirmiyahu. So there, the Chazal say, because Yirmiyahu was not even in Israel, he went to Chutz Laretz to bring back representations of the 10 tribes so that they can keep Yovel again. Okay.
Was there
a machlok
between the two?
It doesn't really fit that model because I certainly don't see it in the text.
Okay.
Because I'll say is that they were related. They're like first cousins.
Is she even mentioned in Sefer Yirmiyahu?
She's not mentioned in Sefer Yirmiyahu. She's mentioned in Yirmiyahu and Malachim.
Right.
The finding of the book is not mentioned in Yirmiyahu.
Right.
Although I think in the very beginning of the book when it says he gave prophecy starting the 18th year of, sorry, the 13th year of Yoshiyahu. Who does that? No one else does that. Right? Or just Haggai says in the second year of Dayadish, but starts Bishnah Shtayim with there.
Yeshayahu Bishnah Smosamelech.
Bishnah Smosamelech. But it doesn't say, and even that's not quite clear. Targum says that the year he became leprous, but it doesn't tell you the actual year. But still, there could be some Amos says they started giving prophecy 2 years before the earthquake, but I think what he's doing is that the book was found in the 18th year of Yoshiyahu, and he wants people to know that I started talking before they found that book, right? They didn't look for that book because I started getting into the tshuva, right?
Well, maybe the year
Sorry, they didn't do tshuva because they found the book. The finding of the book was part of the tshuva that wasn't initiated because they found the book, that they knew the book. The book was something very special to them. It was Moshe's own, you know, imagine finding Rashi's own handwriting of an original manuscript. That would make sensation, right? So imagine finding Moshe's, the sefer that had Edus on it, that it was Moshe's sefer. And it was a sefer Dvarim. So, and from Rashi to now is a lot more than from Moshe to Yoshiyahu. So I'm just saying, because the Bible critics claim that that's the origins of the Torah, is finding this book, but we're not going there. So I don't see the tension between Huldah and...
You don't know how the Yitari antagonized so much of the population?
Why go to him?
Especially the Tocha.
She doesn't go light on them either, by the way.
No, but you already know what he's saying in the Tocha environment.
Yeah. There is a Gemara that asks, why take it to a woman, Dafka? Because a woman will have more mercy on us in interpreting this book.
Huh.
If the way she spoke to them was mercy, I'd love to see what the...
You don't exactly know.
Yeah.
Sure.
No, that's the prophets speak. You know, there's no... I often use this as the Raya. You know, Yirmiyahu gave prophecy during the reign of five kings. Yoshio for 18 years, Ahaz for 3 months, Yehoyakim for 11 years, Yehoyachin for 3 months, and Tzidkiyahu for 11 years. That's 40 years altogether. And he has lots to say to the last four kings throughout his book, especially Tzidkiyahu, whole parking to Tzidkiyahu. Not one word in the entire book of Yirmiyahu is addressed to Yoshio. Not one word. In fact, the two of them only appear together in the same pasuk, that when in Divrei Yamim, when Yoshio dies, it says Vayikonein Yirmiyahu.
Hmm. That's true.
So why not? Yeah, because it's not the way of prophets in Tanakh. Guys, please eat some of that cake. It's really good cake. Because it's not the way of prophets in Tanakh to knock on the door of the people and say, you guys are doing really good work. Shashikoach. But to go over to a king and say, God is so thrilled and pleased with your activity. You know, it's not the way they do. The whole Tanakh's purpose is to address sinning, not to address fulfillment of mitzvahs. I'm sorry to say, I'm sure. And by the way, I could be sure that the prophets did go over to the people and told them that it just doesn't get written in the Tanakh. Of course, you know, rabbis have to sometimes also, you know, give you a shekoach and say, Ashrecha Yisrael, look at the way we're behaving. What are they, did you hear my words Friday night where they talked about why there's so much talking in shul? And I said, you know, the purpose of Shabbos is to create kehilah, vayakel. There were separate lines in the Beis HaMikdash for the chasanim, for the abelim, so people could know who needs a shiva call, who needs shava brachas. And the Gemara in Sukkah says that the shuls were set up in Alexandria by occupation, right? So one parish says, because no one likes to talk about their occupation, this would keep people quiet in shul. Right? I want to get away from my occupation. If you sit next to all the accountants sitting together, we would have nothing to talk about. So, yeah, right. But another parish is, no, because this way all the people are sitting together in the same field. They'll talk about who needs a job and who needs, who's with me, our person in our guild. When I'm sitting up here and I see everybody's talking, I assume it means that you saw who's going to be kohalin this afternoon and who needs lunch and who needs, you're all talking about all these things. So the prophets, I'm sure, you know, did things like this, but it doesn't get in writing. So the tension between Mordechai and Esther is really how to go about this salvation. Now, he had told her before not to reveal who you are. He never tells us why. But I think, you know, I think, well, do you have any, I think this far should be obvious, no?
Maybe some of them?
I mean, you know.
They're foreigners.
Why didn't Esther just take herself out of the running?
Is that enough?
Why, yeah.
Stamanat. And did they have a long view of the possibilities here about what is
but the insecurity, you know, of Jewish existence, especially, you know, I always have to worry about that.
And so,
especially with colors.
Yeah, but there's a powerful lesson. Yoram Chazoni talks about this: is that the Jews of Germany learned all too tragically in the 30s. Is that when you try to out German the Germans and try to out Persia the Persians? Now it goes back to Gemara in Megillah. Why did the Jews deserve Kliya? Shenehenu misudas Achashverosh. This Suda is being set because Achashverosh is where we started, is celebrating the fact that the Jews are not returning. The anachronism of the Gemara says that Nebuchadnezzar ruled 45 years, Belshazzar ruled 23 years, and this is my third year, 45 plus 23 plus 2 is 70, they're not returned. That's not.
When you think when Haman came up with that, you know, this dispersed people whose white race are not, like, you don't, it must have been like already an anti-Semitic motif that the society must have identified.
Yes. Haman Amnei Yisrael Rava Tsumi Menu means that because they're, they said the Gemara presents it, because they're spread out so far, that's really, the protocols of the elders of Zion. They're an octopus. One of the most nefarious pictures that they always had of the Jew in cartoons is of the octopus. Right. He's got a hand here, he's got a hand there, he's got, you know, he's all over the place. He's got a hand in the government and the media.
Well, also worldwide.
Yeah. So Ahasuerus is Mephuzar Mephurat. It's not just that, you know, not losing anything by getting rid of them, because they're, you know, just a little here, a little there.
Right? Yeah, but they're alien to society. Their ways are different from everybody else's.
Right, which is what I remember hearing the Rav Shear talk about the way Paro felt about the Jews.
Yes, he always compared that.
Yeah. Right, that Paro says, you know, this canard, they'll know Safal Sonevenu, Chambanevenu, Ulamin Aretz, right, so that they'll join an enemy.
The first is Vayero Sanu, no Manu. He made us appear evil.
Right. It's different. You know, Lana means to us. Osana means, Gufa, about us. So this is what Haman is trying to convince. What is his dog in the race? You know, I'm giving a course this semester called villains in Tanakh. You know, a villain always has, you know, he has many motivations. It could be revenge. It could be a vendetta. It could be a, it could be personal gain. It could be, you know, it could be insanity, maybe. But first and foremost, it seems that because he's called Megillas Esther Tzorer HaYehudim, and that is a group. There's a group called the Tzorei Yehuda in Sefer Nehemiah, who didn't like the fact that the Jews seemed to be getting preferential treatment from the Persian kings. Now, Cyrus led a whole series of nations to return, but there's no doubt on the Cyrus cylinder that he plays favorites with the Jews. Maybe he knew that Yeshayahu HaNavi predicted him long in advance. Yeshayahu mentions him twice in his book. Right, if you're not going along with the Deuteronomy Isaiah theory, but that it's originally a prophet from long before, then maybe there was this kind of oracle that he knew. Oh, the Jews spoke about me a long time ago. But be kind. He says in Sefer Ezra, "Being good to your God, I know is good for my kingdom." So I'm not only going to let you go back and build your temple. I'm only going to return all of the Kalim, 5,400 of them. They're numbered in the beginning of Ezra. Which also I haven't seen in the Sefer, but it says, you know, he had a 180-day festival. It says in the beginning of the book, he showed off his grandeur and ostentation to six different types of people, who and it says, mentions five different types of grandeur. Right? So the Gemara says he showed every bit of these five kalim of the Beis HaMikdash to six different types of people for 180 days. That means 5,400 kalim got passed around during that whole festival. Six times five times 180. That's the exact amount of kalim it says in Ezra that were returned to the Beis HaMikdash. So that's why we read Bechelim Kelim Shanim Machus Rav Ki Adam Melech, as if though it's what's so sad about the drinking from cups and different vessels. No, because according to tradition, those are the vessels of the Beis Hamikdash itself.
That's what the Litvak would have some chaspurim, right? To be echad.
Oh my goodness! I never heard that joke before. Someone at the door. It's great. Yeah, it's very funny. A litvak is someone who's.
I know a litvak. Right,
so, yeah, he likes Eicham more than he likes Megillah.
Right. So he's saying Ekkikov, so they still have something for the wives.
Okay, but that's.
And then the question is, what am I saying? The whole Megillah and Eicham? Yeah, they don't want
you to swallow. It's enjoying yourself too much. Okay. All right. So the idea of Ahasuerus wearing the big day kahuna and celebrating the fact that Yerushalayim is not. So again, I'm keep doing this, but. On Shabbos, I'm going to show this textually. You know, like the fact that the Shushan is called Shushan HaBira, right? And the only other city in the whole Tanakh called Bira is, of course,
doesn't that point to a very strong anti-Semitic streak in the whole culture of just going around in the big day? He's mocking.
Yeah, he's mocking the fact that you are not. Are not succeeding in getting back to your.
But it's like, if you count Jews, I mean, what can do it to them?
Right.
Right.
What we always say is what makes the anti-Semitism is that why is only this the thing that bothers you? So many other things that could and should bother you, it's only this. So, but Maisa, all of these, Yerushalayim is becoming Shushan, basically, just becoming the Chatzer of Ahasuerus, and the Torah, and its first parak especially uses certain terminologies to describe the ostentation of Ahasuerus, and using words that only appear in Tanakh outside of the Megillas Esther regarding the Mishkan of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Jews are invited to this. Okay, maybe they felt they have to attend for political reasons, but to enjoy it. That one word for that Shimon Bar Yochai says Shinenu Misudas Achashverosh, that the Jews were bragging about their World War I medals, and they thought that would protect them from nothing's good, you know, nothing doing, right? So I'm not saying per se that you know, serving for Germany and being patriotic to Germany was something
which should have been. Until Hindenburg, I'd have to do the same.
What's it
doing? Hide them. Yeah, because he actually intervened. What
year was that?
I think he died in 1932, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after he appointed Hitler chancellor.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of things didn't work in our favor there, but that's the conclusion of this discussion of the way men and women approach. That's this. Okay. Now I'm just going to give you the introduction of this one, and then we'll go to a conclusion for in a week. So there's a pasuk in Koheles, in Perek Tes, that says, I'll paraphrase the pasuk. The pasuk says that it's most debilitating in life for the human that we can suddenly be caught up in a net like a fish while swimming and like a bird in flight. And then repeats the word suddenly. That's the most debilitating aspect is that, and at the very least, it should make us humble. You know, we could be riding high and just out of nowhere, in so many different ways, a brick falling from the top of a building, or an errant car that tops the curb, or so many, 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 many other things.
Those are in their natural environment. They're swimming in the sea and they're flying and birds are
flying. Right, and just in a moment's notice, they don't even realize he uses the bird and the fish. Right? This morning I had a dentist appointment, and to my horror, and I had my phone and my coat, to my horror, exact same coat without my phone in the pocket was in the closet. But I felt something else in the coat, which was a cleaner's ticket with the name of the person on the ticket. So I showed it to the receptionist. He said, oh yeah, he had an appointment 45 minutes ago. He left. He goes, I know, he left with my coat. So it turns out that his wife had an appointment shortly afterwards. She was still home and she lived a block away. So I got my coat, but it delayed me about 20 minutes. Fortunately, I always have a Gemara with me. But it made me change my plans for how I was going to get to school and to teach right afterwards. So my approach to this is that I was going to take the crosstown bus and the one to school, and instead I had to take a taxi, paid a lot more money. But my approach to this is that maybe something would have happened to me on the train or something, that this was God's way of saying, this is what you have to do today. This is part of your, I have no way of knowing this, of course. But the pitomius of life is that we have to try to not just gamzul tova or komadov gamav tava, but to try to fit every nuance of the different things that happen to us. And I know some of my kids have every Friday night they talk about the siyata deshmaya moments this past week, where they feel that Hashem was there for them and it made a difference. And so it's a good faith point, right? So this is the explanation the Rav gave for why the holiday is called Purim. Purim seems to be such a minute aspect of what animates this story. But then if the Rav shows, first he beats down the question and shows Adarabba. Let's listen to the reason why it's called that. But imagine, you know, you're talking and just instead of transliterating what the holiday is called, you know, how about translating it in Hebrew? It's Chag HaGorolot. That would seem strange, wouldn't it? You know, we're going for your lots, Seuda. Peel Pur Hu Hagoral, right? So Purim is just a Persian word, right? So what is it about the way that Haman chose the day? He put months in this bowl. He put 30 days in that bowl. Adar, 13. Good. Let's kill the Jews on Adar 13. So that seems to be a minute detail in the story that gives the holiday its name. Right? So that's precisely what he took from Koheles, is that the goraliut, or the capriciousness of our existence. And then he goes so beautifully about the different things we do in our daily activities, especially our daily Shmoneh Esrei. Right, we're busy asking for 13 things in our daily Shmoneh Esrei, the bulk of which I'm doing pretty well with God. Right? Yeah, okay, you know, I need some help, God, with the shir, you know, right? The slach lanu tshuva fainu, you know, parnasa. Every one of these things. Of course, you can say I'm not praying for me. You know, I'm running in a marathon next week. I'm praying for my friend. I'm praying for someone else. I'm praying for the klal. That's why we pray in plural. But the Rav said, no, perish that thought. You're praying for yourself each and every day also. For the maintenance of your da'as. Right? You could say, well, I'm too young for dementia. No, everything needs maintenance. And it's humility that should make us feel this way. Right, just in a snap, forget about health and you're at a doctor's appointment and you say everything seems to be good and he calls you back because, right? I got a call back at my last yearly because my sodium was low. Usually, the problem is your sodium is high. My sodium is high. I know why, because I drink so much in the morning. I drink like 96 ounces of water before I come to shul. So starting very early in the morning. So I usually, when I have the annual appointment, I don't do that. But this time I didn't. And I just drove down the sodium. So he had to call me back. All right. But sometimes the call back is because there's a spot on your liver or there's a big mass in your lungs or chas v'shalom. So who knows, right? You just sitting high and pretty, and all of a sudden there's this. Oh my goodness, I can't believe that. What is that? What's that? What's that thing I feel with it? Right. So that's the goraliut of life. Don't be obsessive with this, right? Some people walk around obsessing over this. Don't do that because that's not good either, right? Just walk around with the faith that Kadosh Baruch Hu, Shem Ro'i Lo Echsor, right, and Lo Ira Raki Atayim Adi, right. So I'll close with the connection that the Rav made, which was I have to find that. I think it's the first made in the Zohar. I'm quite sure it's not a Gemara because I would. Not that I know every single Gemara by heart, but if this was a Gemara, we'd know it. It's a Zohar, that Yom Kippurim is a Yom Kippurim. Right? It doesn't sound like a Gemara. Right? That day of atonement is a day like Purim. Now, that does not translate well. The day of atonement is not like Purim at all. Right? One is fasting and one is feasting, and one is somber and one is... Is quite the opposite. So what's going on here? So at first glance, and it's only the Rav who really comes up with this so amazingly, is that the Goral is a major focus of Yom Kippur as well. Mm-hmm. Right? So in fact, the Rav says it's the showcase of Yom Kippur. Everything else is leading to this one thing, Traf B'Kalpi. Azazel, Kodesh Lashem, and something as capricious as the lot determines this thing. And when you consider the Latin etymology of capricious, it means like a goat. Okay, Capri is a goat. So because a goat is very, very, it's fickle. Yeah, it goes one direction, all of a sudden it turns around, goes the other direction. It's not predictable because life isn't predictable. Right? When Chazal thought that Koheles doesn't belong in the canon of Tanakh, so they gave their explanations. One of them is that it's filled with contradictions. So good Shabbos, yeah, life is contradictory. Right? And Tehillim is also, Koheles is very pessimistic initially, is optimistic, and Tehillim is realistic. Tehillim has everything in it. You have some psukim that say, Hinelo Inimbalo Yishon Shomer Yisrael. You have some psukim that say, Ura Hashem Lamat Yishon. Right? So it depends how what the situation is. So we'll start with this, some more of this this page here. And I have one more article that compares Purim with Yom Kippur and Koheles and some of that, what we just did, that appeared in one of the Rav's very first publications. He didn't write it, but it was his Torah. Was called Reflections of the Rav back in the 50s by Avraham Bezdin. Does anybody have it?
Right.
It's two volumes. It should be easy to get. I think it's always being reprinted. It's called Reflections of the Rav. It's in the first volume. And I believe the article is called Man is Vulnerable. And isn't that what it's all about?
Yom Kippur, did you write this? Was it?
Avraham Bezdin wrote it, but it's his Torah. And Yom Kippur is all about our vulnerabilities, right? The vicissitudes of life. And we stand before God and say, God, you know us best. You created us. You know what my weaknesses are. I'm trying hard. I may be here next year saying all the same complaints and all the same al-chaits, but I'm trying to make myself a little better each time. And I would like to make my case to deserve another year.
Isn't it like when Van Tucker became like the central point, because it's mia terre,
me and Muslims. So the goral is as if though sometimes we see the things that happened the past year is who I remember I was teaching at Ramaz when that girl was Mrs. Jenny Michael's granddaughter, that she was on that trip to Honduras to help the victims of an earthquake. And on the way to the airport, the bus fell down the ravine and she was crushed. And she had just changed seats with someone, and where the new seat she had was really where all the bad stuff happened, and where she was sitting before, the girl that was sitting there was survived. So the students asked me, was her gzeira last Yom Kippur that she should die? Right. So you're gonna say, well, yeah, everybody who dies, the last Yom Kippur, it said that person shall die, no? So I couldn't answer that way. I said, no, a girl like this in her age, her gzeira was to live. She exercised her free will to do certain things that set in motion, who am I to know how God runs these things, but that set in motion some a different situation. God doesn't want anyone to die like that. But because I could not tell my students, because she was a student teacher there, and she was so beloved. It was, remember they had the funeral there, and a few of them attended, and it was like the whole school was crying. And they had the girl's mother was in my class, Jenny Michael's youngest daughter, and it was really, it was awful. But I couldn't tell the class that her gzeira the year before was to die. All right, but who knows these things with God? So we're going to discuss the Koheles, Esther, Yom Kippur theme. Okay. So again, as you see, the Monday night class is going to be more in theory, not as textual, but the Shabbos class will be mamish with the text open, and we'll see some of these things in the psukim themselves. Okay, so if you have time, try to read this over the week. Okay, I'm giving you homework. Okay. Okay, everybody, have a great week.